entire new fields of debris have surfaced.
Military investigators look through a half-century-old plane crash site on a retreating glacier. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the dream of college becomes a reality for a Hmong refugee who is determined to become a nurse.
So I think that it's going to be tough for me when I go to UAA, and think that I need to work more harder and I need to study more.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Military specialists are surveying an old plane crash site in the Kinnick Glacier area. The C-124 Globemaster went down there in 1952, and some of the debris was spotted last June. A team from the Hawaii-based Joint POW-MIA Accounting Command, or JPAC, initially searched the site in 2012 for materials and possible victims' remains. The team is back this year to recover what evidence it can that will help identify those who perished in the crash. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
A retreating colony glacier is revealing bit by bit scraps of the lives lost when the old cargo transport went down over half a century ago. JPAC's Lee Tucker said the melting glacier has uncovered more of the debris field this year. The plane's manifest indicates 52 people were on the downed flight.
It's an important mission. Not only are we looking for these 52 individuals around the world, JPAC is looking for 84,000 of our missing service members. That's why this is important to us. We hope to be able to provide closure to these service members' families.
Tucker spoke at a meeting with the media on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson on Tuesday. He was joined by Dr. Greg Berg, a forensic anthropologist and recovery team leader who was still dressed in field gear, having just stepped off a flight coming in from the wreck site.
So this year what we've seen is a dramatic shift down glacier, which has then brought new materials to light, number one. Number two, it's brought completely different areas to light than were present last year.
Berg says the recovery site is as long as two football fields, stretched lengthwise and riddled with dangerous crevasses.
And the materials that were down in the bottom of those crevasses came back up a little bit, or the melt came down. But whatever that was, it allowed those areas that we couldn't get to last year to come to light again.
But the team has recovered items that could link debris to actual human beings.
The things that we keep are things that are directly related to an individual on that aircraft, something that we can tie straight back to them. Let's say something like a journal or dog tags or clothing items that may have the name in it.
Berg says some human remains from the wreck are being analyzed at a JPAC laboratory, but he declined to discuss any further information regarding victim identification. He did say two ID tags had been recovered at this point. Berg pointed to a table strewn with flotsam and jetsam, a crushed metal canteen, a shredded mail bag, crumpled cigarette packages still bearing the Camel and Philip Morris logos, along with remarkably preserved packets of survival gear. But 11th Air Force historian Douglas Beckstead said no one could have survived the Globemaster's crash.
And you want to know what caused the crash? Bad weather. The accident investigation report from 1953 was done completed several months later, and the plane basically flew into a mountain. It was in the clouds, they couldn't see, and it flew into the side of Mount Gannett.
Military officials knew the plane was in the vicinity, but it wasn't until last summer that an Alaska Army National Guard crew on a routine mission spotted pieces of the wreck revealed by the shrinking glacier. Berg stresses that the recovery team is only looking at a small portion of the aircraft. Now that the glacier is retreating even faster, Berg says further recovery efforts are likely. A second team started moving the debris from the glacier on Tuesday, taking 1,800 pounds back by day's end. Their plan is to remove as much of the wreck's debris this year as is possible, monitor the area, and determine what future recovery missions are needed. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The U.S. Forest Service says it's speeding up Tongass National Forest's transition from an old growth management plan to a second growth plan. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the shift is scheduled to take 10 to 15 years and frustrates both environmental groups and loggers.
For years, the stated goal has been to move toward harvesting the new growth trees, to preserve the iconic old growth trees that serve as a backbone to the Tongass. That's been agreed to by the government, environmental community, and to a point, the logging industry. So you could expect the announcement to be welcomed by everyone involved.
Today's news wasn't very good. We had been hoping that they were putting together a document that would lead us out of old growth logging in the Tongass National Forest, and they fell short today.
That's Owen Graham, the executive director of the Alaska Forest Association, and his often foe, Tim Bristol of Trout Unlimited. Both are let down. Graham, because the transition period to new growth is too short, and Bristol, because that same transition period is too long. Beth Pendleton is in charge of the U.S. Forest Service in Alaska. She says Monday's announcement that there will be a large timber sale on Prince of Wales Island is the first step in the transition period. The Big Thorn Timber Project is expected to produce some 150 million board feet. She says that project will create some 600 jobs over the next 6 to 10 years, but does not have an estimate for new jobs for the entire transition that's expected to last a decade.
By that point in time, we will be harvesting the vast percentage of the timber harvest on the Tongass would be made up of young growth timber.
It takes decades for a tree to reach maturity, to reach a point where it's profitable to cut it, mill it, and ship it. The Forest Association's Owen Graham says in 15 years, the new growth still won't be ready to harvest.
It takes about 90 to 100 years to grow to maturity, and the oldest of our stands right now, other than a few exceptions, are about 55 years old, so it's a long ways from maturity.
Graham says the few operating mills in southeast Alaska are designed for bigger trees. If the mill owners need to process new growth, they could potentially lose clients because the young trees produce different products, such as 2x4s and 2x6s. Tim Bristol with Trout Unlimited says most in Southeast assumed the timber wars were fought in the past, and the region was moving toward an economy based around salmon. Until now.
The Forest Service is in the Department of Agriculture, and it's sort of in their DNA to think about logging and timber sales. And for far too long, they've failed to grasp the fact that they are the managers of a salmon forest.
The federal government will work with local entities, tribes, and interested groups to implement the plan. And Bristol says as it unfolds, the environmental community will make sure its opposition is heard. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Over the past year, a Virginia-based company has been helping Unalaska get rid of millions of pounds of scrap metal. They're finally nearing the finish line. And now, as KUCB's Audrey Carlson reports, they're looking to expand to nearby islands.
It's a problem that Unalaska has been dealing with for years. How to get rid of the huge volumes of unwanted scrap metal that pile up around the city. Shipping anything off of the island is expensive. And given the low price of scrap metal, it's been hard to find a company that thinks it's worth it.
I think if it was a non-family business coming up here, I doubt they'd be able to do it.
That's Richard Moore. He's the son of Ron Moore, who owns a scrapping company based out of Norfolk, Virginia. The Moores approached the city last year with an offer to help and got a $60,000 contract in return. In March of 2012, the whole family moved to Unalaska to begin collecting, removing, and selling scrap metal. Richard Moore says they ended up staying much longer than expected.
We originally planned to be here for about 3 months, and we're still here. It started up a cleanup project, and now just more scrap just keeps generating, and haven't got a chance to get it all cleaned up yet.
Moore estimates that his father's company has shipped 200 to 300 loads, totaling 8 to 9 million pounds of scrap metal. That includes around 600 crushed vehicles, as well as old processing machinery, boat trailers, yard equipment, and home appliances. City officials estimate that 70 to 75% of the island's scrap has been removed since last summer, but there's still more to be done. The family plans to stay in Unalaska for another year or so before heading east to Sand Point to do a similar cleanup.
Actually, we'd like to clean up the whole Aleutian chain, to tell you the truth. We're going to try to get everybody cleaned up for years to come.
But although demand is high, Ron Moore, that's Richard Moore's father, says metal scrapping isn't a very lucrative endeavor in the Aleutians, at least not for now.
It's not making a whole lot of money, I can tell you that. The price of steel is way down.
With the variable pricing of metals, Moore says it's a huge gamble to rent land in Alaska to store the scrap while waiting for prices to go back up. But he says he can afford to eat the losses thanks to reduced shipping rates from Sampson Tug and Barge, the company responsible for transporting Moore's collected scrap from Unalaska down to Seattle. So while Moore isn't making a fortune recycling metal in the Aleutians, he says he's sticking around on principle.
We tell you we're going to do something, we're going to do it. I told you I'm going to clean up Dutch Harbor, I'm going to clean it up.
Which means that Moore might be around for quite a while. Without a longer-term solution to the problem of scrap metal accumulation, Unalaska will probably be needing his services again in the near future. In Unalaska, I'm Audrey Carlson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, renowned Tlingit carvings will go on display for the first time in decades.
The whalehouse carvings and paintings rank among some of the most extraordinary works of world art, not just native art.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by...
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
An East High School graduate is on her way to college at UAA. That transition is noteworthy because the student is a refugee, has two kids, and barely spoke English when she started high school. Peng Tao attributes her success to a specialized counselor who recently lost her job because of school district budget cuts. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Peng Tao's husband is driving her from the trailer court, where they share a home with their in-laws, around the corner to one of her last days at East High School. Tao's high school years were not easy. While many of her peers were attending homecoming football games and texting on smartphones, Tao was balancing adult responsibilities with being a full-time student. She was married at 15 and had her first baby in 10th grade. Dropping out didn't cross her mind, though, even after her second child was born, just before her senior year. She wants to be a nurse.
One step at a time, like my English teacher, she told me. I know it's kind of hard because I'm bilingual, so I think that it's going to be tough for me when I go to UAA. And I think that I need to work more harder and I need to study more because I know that education will be succeed in the future for my families. So I can help my family too. And also I want to be a role model for my two kids.
The petite brunette wears her long dark hair tied back in a bun. She's the first person in her family to graduate from high school and enroll in college. And getting to that graduation took determination. I followed Tao through the crowded halls of East on her way to her first class of the day.
Right now we're going to the integrated math class. Yeah. Sometimes I miss a lot of homework in that class, but I try my best to catch up on my homework.
So inverse tangent of 155 over...
Hmong is Tao's first language. The youngest of seven children, she was born in a refugee camp in Thailand. Her parents fled from Laos after her father fought for America during the Vietnam War. He passed away in 2000, and her mother eventually returned to Laos. But not before sending 10-year-old Tao to the U.S. with her older brother. They moved to Anchorage in 2008. Her road to graduation has been full of twists and turns that led her to Vonnie Gaither's office.
I help kids with life after high school, post-secondary education, jobs, just about everything and anything.
Gaither was the career resource advisor at East, the largest and most diverse school in the district. 3/4 of the 2,200 or so students are minorities. About 20% officially get help with English, and around half speak another language at home. Gaither says as a Hmong woman, Tao faces unique gender challenges.
Hmong girls, they usually don't go on to post-secondary education. Their main responsibility is to take care of the family. She's exceptional because she's fighting her traditional cultural ways. She's in high school, married, 2 babies, but yet she's really involved in school and outside of school. She takes advantage of any opportunity or anything that will benefit her.
Tao says regular meetings with Gaither helped her stay on track for graduation. She earned a scholarship from UAA for being in the top 10% of her class. Tao was one of the last students that Gaither served. Her job was cut at the end of the school year. Paige Petter is an English language learner counselor at East who's keeping her job. She says she's seeing more and more students like Tao who are navigating the school system alone.
Even if their parents are there for support, a lot of times the parents don't speak the language, don't know the culture. Maybe the parents don't have the level of education even that the children do. And so the children grow up very quickly and they're making adult type decisions.
Petter's department will lose one counselor next year as well due to cuts. A graduation support coach was also let go. Tao made it to graduation, she says, due in large part to the nurturing she got from specialized counselors like the ones that were cut, especially Gaither.
Like when every time when you need her, she always be there for you.
Tao says she's excited and nervous to start college. I visited her at her trailer home on a sunny afternoon earlier this summer.
I'm making fried rice.
She was cooking lunch for about a dozen kids, including her 2-year-old, Carissa, and her 1-year-old, Mark. She says she started summer school at UAA in May, hoping to get one math class out of the way. But she confesses she ended up dropping the class because family obligations took over.
During the summer, my husband, like they have like a lot of plan to go like fishing, hunting, and camping. So I think that maybe it would be best for me to withdraw my math class until the fall.
Tao adds her husband recently told her he wants more sons, and that makes her nervous. But she says she's determined to graduate from college. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A Tlingit clan has decided that a collection of renowned carvings will be publicly displayed in the village. The decision will hopefully put to rest a generations-old struggle within the clan of whether the carvings should be kept in the village or sold and preserved in museums. Margaret Friedenauer of KHNS in Haines has more.
After decades of disagreement, the Gonak Teidi clan of Klukwan has agreed to allow treasured carvings of their whale house to be publicly displayed at a future cultural center planned for the village. The carvings have been the center of controversy in the village and beyond for nearly a century. The pieces are twice that old and are valued among the powerful Whale House clan for their cultural and spiritual significance. They are also revered in the art world as some of the premier examples of Northwest Coast Native art. Aldona Jonitis is the interim director of the University of Alaska Museum of the North.
The Whale House carvings and paintings rank among some of the most extraordinary works of world art, not just native art, and they're total masterpieces. And it is extraordinary that the clan is now willing to let other people see these magnificent works of art.
The carvings include house posts, a wall screen, and a large feast dish. They've estimated to have been carved in the early 1800s by a carver from near Wrangell. The same man carved the interior house posts for the chief sheikh's house there. The carvings began gaining recognition from outsiders more than 100 years ago. Collectors and art dealers longed after them, and large sums of money were offered to purchase them. But it was disputed over the years whether the pieces belonged to individuals or the entire clan. At one point in the mid-1980s, the items were sold to a Seattle art dealer by some clan members. Other clan members sued and halted the sale. After a lengthy court case, the items arrived back in the village in 1994. They have not been seen publicly since. It's not known by outsiders if the items are now in the whale house in Klukwan or being kept elsewhere for safekeeping. Current Hitsat-Tee or caretaker Jones Hotch Jr. won't say. He also won't go into detail about the decision among clan members to display the items. The clan meeting took place on June 2nd in Haines. More than 40 Gonak Tedi clan members traveled from across the country to attend. But Hotch does say there was good discussion at the meeting that brought about agreement to place the items in the planned Jilkat Kwan Heritage Center in the village. It's a move Hotch supports.
I feel like this was the best place for them to be, for them, so they can last the longest.
Those in the clan who opposed the sale of the items in years past haven't always agreed the items should be on public display. The cultural center is still a year or more from completion, but with the promise of some of the most renowned and treasured Northwest Coast art being housed there, more funds and support for the center may come about. And many in the art world and general public will be anxiously awaiting the opening of the center. Reporting in Haines, this is Margaret Friednauer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
If you're in Juneau, Fairbanks, or Anchorage tomorrow, you may hear the bells of the Catholic Church ringing at noon. Catholics in Alaska have been observing a two-week period leading up to July 4th, called the Fortnight for Freedom. It's part of an effort by the church to highlight what they see as a chipping away at the First Amendment and the right to religious freedom. Catholic leaders in the state sent a letter encouraging church members to speak out against infringements on religious expression. Fairbanks Bishop Donald Kettler says it's a good time for reflection on religious freedom, not just for the church, but for all citizens.
We don't believe this is a Catholic issue. We believe this is a United States constitutional issue, that we have to protect religious liberty, and that in the concept that's not just narrow, so narrow that it focuses only on places of worship, but there's other ways that our religious freedoms can be infringed upon, and we're concerned about that.
Some of those concerns are the Affordable Care Act's mandate that Catholic schools, hospitals, and businesses would be required to provide contraceptives and other reproductive services to employees. The church is opposed to contraception. The Obama administration in June gave those religious organizations an exemption, but refused to extend it to other businesses that cited opposition based on religious beliefs. While the totem pole is one of the most recognizable forms of outdoor art in Alaska, it's also one of the least permanent. At Sitka National Historical Park, many of the original totems have been recarved, which until recently has been the only way to preserve this art form. Now, museum professionals are starting to use computer technology to make digital copies of totems. KCAW's Eric Newman met with National Park Service architects last weekend as they scanned one of Sitka's important totems.
I'm an architect with the National Park Service out of Washington, D.C. I work for a program called Heritage Documentation Programs.
That's Mark Shara from the Library of Congress. And that is the sound of history being made. Well, kind of. Over the weekend, Shara and his team visited Sitka from Washington, D.C. They were here as part of a program to document the totem poles in Sitka National Historical Park. But the tools used for this project were very different from the chisels and adzes used to carve the totems in the first place.
We're doing mostly what's called 3D laser scanning, which involves a machine, a 3D laser scanner, which shoots a laser at the object. In fact, it shoots about 50,000 points a second.
The scanner Shara is talking about is a device that will create three-dimensional images of the totem poles for the park's visitor center and website. When they're done, they'll have incredibly accurate pictures of the totems for future maintenance by the park and for the Library of Congress, which will get a set of architectural drawings for their permanent collection. Shara says he was sent to Alaska because these totems are unique.
Actually, I work out of Washington, but I work in national parks all across the country, and I think this is a unique resource. This is really, from my personal experience, an amazing place, and the totem poles are simply amazing objects. And so I'm sure the Library of Congress is going to be very excited to have this as part of the record.
To scan all the way up the totem poles, Shara stands on a mechanical lift that raises him and the camera up in the air. The camera is mounted on a tripod and is about the size of a mailbox. As it slowly spins around, it records literally millions of points of information in what Shara calls a point cloud. Then, he takes a series of panoramic photographs that are layered on top and get plotted to those points. The end result? Something like a Google Map version of the totem poles. They're still experimenting with exactly what it'll look like. But he describes a fly-through, where viewers will be able to see all the parts of the carving up close. But he says the technology is still new, and they're using it for this project in a different way.
I'm not aware of anything specifically like this. Traditionally, we do buildings, you know, and you do a set of standard architectural drawings. But the totems are so sculptural, they're hard to capture in traditional drawings, and it's only with the advent of this new technology. We've only been doing this for the last 5 years that we've been able to capture objects like this. It's kind of new for all of us, so we're just trying to stretch the boundaries of what we can do with this these technologies.
Over the weekend, Shara and his team documented 11 of the 19 totem poles in the park. They'll be back next weekend to finish the remaining 8. The Visitor Center hopes to have interpretation from this project available in the fall. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Eric Newman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Audrey Carlson in Unalaska, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, and Eric Newman in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskananookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.